Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man number 28, War Path of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby, with performances by James Lewis, Tim Getman, Elizabeth Jernigan, Drew Copas, Tim Carlin, James Konacek, Michael Glenn, Richard Rowan, Mort Shelby, Ken Jackson, James Keegan, Kimberly Gilbert, Thomas Penny, Christopher Sheeran, Christopher Graybill, Terrence Asenford, and Joe Brack.
Smoke Jensen was in front of the hardware store, looping the reins of his horse around the hitching rail. A masked man appeared in the doorway of the bank holding a smoking gun in his hand. Up and down the street, citizens of the town scrambled to get out of the way, running into nearby doorways, ducking behind water troughs, or around the corners of buildings. Three more masked men appeared in the bank door.
Clear the street! Clear the street! Everybody get off the street!
Although most of the citizens obeyed the bank robber's orders, Smoke Jensen did not. Instead, he strolled almost casually to his horse and pulled his rifle from its saddle holster. Then, jacking a shell into the chamber, he stepped out into the middle of the street and raised the rifle to his shoulder.
What the hell?
One of the robbers aimed at Smoke. Smoke returned fire, and he didn't miss. Now there were only two of the robbers left.
Get the money! Let's get out of here!
The other robber tried to retrieve the money bag from the hands of one of the two robbers Smoke had killed, but Smoke put a bullet in his leg. The last robber, now seeing that he was alone and outgunned by the man with the rifle, threw his pistol down and put his hands up.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! I quit!
Keeping the robber covered, Smoke walked toward him. By now, most of the townspeople realized that Smoke had everything under control. They started coming back into the streets, heading for the bank and the two robbers who were left alive, one standing with his hands up, the other bleeding, lying in the dirt.
Who are you, mister?
Why do you need to know? It's not like we're going to be friends or anything.
Mister, you just been brought down by Smoke Jensen. And if it's any consolation to you, he's beaten many a man better than you.
By now, Sheriff Monte Carson was also on the scene, and he took the two robbers into custody.
What about my leg? I got me a bullet in my leg. I need a doctor. I'm your prisoner, and the law says you've got to get me to a doctor.
We've only got one doctor in this town, mister, and right now, he's seeing Mrs. Pinchon and Mr. Flowers. You better hope neither one of them dies, because if either of them does, you'll be hung for murder. Let's go.
Monty made a motion toward the jail.
I can't walk on this leg, I tell you.
Couple of you men help him.
With assistance from two onlookers, the wounded man and his uninjured partner crossed the street and entered the jail.
We've got two nice rooms just waiting for you.
Monty opened the door to adjacent jail cells.
Hey, when's the doctor gonna look at my leg?
When he gets around to it. In the meantime, if I were you, I'd just lie on that bunk there and take it easy.
It hurts!
Yeah, I reckon it does. What are your names?
I'm Jack Tatum.
The uninjured man nodded toward the other robber, who had taken Monty's advice and was now lying on the bunk.
His name's Billy Petrie.
Tatum. I've seen that name.
Monty opened the drawer of his desk and took out a pile of wanted posters. After looking through several of them, he pulled one out.
Ah, here it is. This is you, isn't it?
Monty turned the poster so Tatum could see it.
Wanted Jack Tatum for murder and robbery. $5,000 reward to be paid dead or alive. Only 5,000? Aye, they're a bunch of skinflints. Hell, I'm worth more than that.
Proud of it, are you? I reckon I better get a telegram off. No doubt some folks are going to be happy to hear that you are out of business.
Sheriff, what are you going to do about that fellow that murdered my two friends?
I beg your pardon? Did you say murdered?
Yeah, I said murdered. Because that's what he done. We wasn't shooting anybody. We was just shooting the air to clear the street. Next thing I know, that bank teller was down. Then that woman came crashing through the window. Then Fuller and Howard. And then Billy was shot. The fella doing the shooting, Jensen, I think someone said, was a crazy man. Sending bullets flying everywhere. You ask me, he's the one who should be locked up in here.
Are you trying to tell me that you didn't have anything to do with shooting Mr. Flowers or Mrs. Pinchon?
That's what I'm telling you.
I give you this, Tatum. You got gall telling a lie like that when the whole town saw what you did.
Well, now, some folks may have seen it one way and some the other. We're going to get a trial, aren't we? Or do you plan on just hanging us?
You'll get a fair trial, and then we'll hang you.
Dr. Spaulding walked into Monty's office, and he set his bag on the corner of Monty's desk.
How's Mrs. Pinchon?
She'll be all right. Bullet went all the way through her upper arm, but it didn't hit any bones.
Rich Flowers?
Dead. He's dead before I even got to him.
That's a shame. Flowers was a nice man.
Yes, he was. And the really sad thing is, Edna, his wife, is gonna have a baby.
Damn, that's a shame. What about the two bank robbers? Both dead?
Yeah.
Listen, Doc, I want you to do me a favor. Take the bullets out of the bodies. No doubt the court will need them for evidence.
All right. I understand one of your prisoners is wounded.
Yeah, he's on his cot back there. Took a bullet in his leg.
I'll take a look at it.
Spaulding picked up his bag and headed toward the cell.
Sheriff!
What is it now, Tatum?
I want to see my lawyer. That's my right, ain't it? See a lawyer?
You have that right.
And if I don't have one, you have to appoint him.
That's right.
Well, then appoint a lawyer for me. Get him over here.
Hold still, young man. If I don't get this bullet out, you're likely to lose that leg. Here's some laudanum.
The laudanum took effect. Monty was just finishing the telegram he was gonna send when Dewey Wallace, a recently hired deputy, came in.
Woo-wee! Town is really buzzing over all the excitement this morning.
Is Welch seeing to the bodies yet?
You bet. He had his measuring tape out before they were cold.
I need you to take this down to the telegraph office.
All right.
Dewey looked at the sheriff's message.
You think he'll pay Smoke Jensen that reward?
I don't know why they shouldn't.
Wallace walked over to the jail cells and stood just outside the bars, looking at the two prisoners as he drank his coffee.
So, what were you fellas thinking? Did you think we're such a small town, you could just come in here and rob our bank, then leave without so much as a fare thee well?
Tatum glared at the deputy, but he said nothing.
Quiet, huh? Well, I reckon you won't be so quiet when we string you up.
Holding his hand beside his neck to represent a rope, he made a jerking motion.
Yeah, you won't be so quiet then.
Wallace! Get the hell away from themselves and quit bothering the prisoners. Take that telegram down to Western Union like I told you.
All right, Sheriff. Whatever you say.
Doc Spaulding came back from Petrie's cell.
What I was thinking when I hired that boy.
Yeah, he'll come around. Here's the bullet I took from his leg.
What is it? 44-40?
Is that what Jensen was shooting?
Yeah.
And that's what it is. Of course, it's pretty hard to tell the difference between a 44 and a 44-40. Seeing as they're so close to the same size and weight.
That's true.
Monty had opened a small notebook and was looking through it. He found what he was looking for.
Whew. Jensen's not gonna like this.
He's not gonna like what?
Sam Covington is next in line to be the public defender.
You're right. He's not gonna like it.
I tell you who else won't like it. Norton, the prosecuting attorney. If anyone can make a case out of this, it'll be Sam Covington.
Covington's good, all right.
Good has nothing to do with it. As far as I know, every lawyer in the county is good. But Covington is more than good. He is ruthless. He'll do anything it takes to win a case. Any case. It doesn't matter to Covington whether something is right or wrong, or whether someone is guilty or innocent. All that matters to him is who wins and who loses.
When Smoke Jensen returned home to the Sugarloaf, the aroma of fried chicken assailed his nostrils as he entered the house. And going into the kitchen, he saw Sally standing over the stove. He stepped up behind and put his arms around her.
Mmm. Mmm. That smells good.
What smells good? The fried chicken or the $5 an ounce perfume I'm wearing?
Perfume, of course. Well, the chicken, too, but definitely the perfume.
Oh, you're the biggest liar I know. Not only am I not wearing any perfume, you know full well that I would never be foolish enough to spend $5 for 1 ounce, especially when I could put essence of fried chicken behind my ears and accomplish the same thing, as far as you're concerned.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you don't need perfume or fried chicken. To me, you always smell good.
Uh-huh. Don't you try and butter me up now, Mr. Smoke Jensen. Especially after what happened in town today. You go into town to make a simple purchase at the hardware store, and you wind up in a gunfight.
How'd you hear about it so fast?
Well, I'm glad to see that you aren't going to deny it. Mrs. Fremont was in town, and she saw the whole thing. You better believe she couldn't wait to stop by and tell me about it.
She always was a busybody.
You can't blame her. She figures that is her purpose in life.
Then you also heard about Rich Flowers.
Yes, I heard. And poor Edna is pregnant. Pregnant and a widow. It's terrible. But you had no business putting yourself on the line like that. One man against four? Did you want to make me a widow, too? What were you thinking?
I don't know. It just seemed like the thing to do at the time. You aren't mad at me, are you?
Oh, do I get mad at a raindrop for getting my hair wet? Some things are just acts of nature. And when you see someone in trouble, you have just naturally got to come to their rescue. It's who you are.
You're a good woman, Sally. I don't know how I was ever lucky enough to find you. Or why you were foolish enough to marry me. All I know is, you're the best thing that ever happened to me.
Better be careful, cowboy. Talk like that would get you.
Woo-wee, I'm starved. And does that ever smell good?
Damn, Pearly. If you don't have the worst timing in the world.
Timing seems pretty good to me. I mean, the food's about ready, isn't it?
Yes, it's ready. Wash up. I'll have it on the table shortly.
Pearly, a young man just past 20, was the acting foreman of Sugarloaf, having come to work for Smoke after a stint as a hired gun. But the concept of being a hired gun had soured when some of the men Pearly was working with had raped and killed a young girl. Pearly had quit that job and thrown in with Smoke, whose ranch had been the target of the man Pearly was working for at the time. Since then, Pearly had proved to be one of the most loyal and hungry people Smoke had ever known. Cal came into the house right behind Pearly. Cal was a couple of years younger than Pearly. While his appetite wasn't quite as large as Pearly's, his loyalty to Smoke and Sally was just as intense. Smoke and Sally felt like they were two of their own children.
Wish I'd been with you for a little fracas in town.
Why? What could you have done that Smoke didn't do?
Watch.
While Big Rock did not have a courthouse, it did have a city administration building, with an area that was set aside specifically to be used as a courthouse when the occasion demanded. However, there was no permanently sitting judge, and because of that, there was a 2-day delay while they waited for Harry Tutwiler, circuit judge of the 3rd Judicial District, to come to town to conduct the trial. The judge was met by Sheriff Monty Carson, Abner Norton, the prosecuting attorney, and Emil Bartholomew, the president of the bank. In addition, there were several other townspeople on hand because the upcoming trial was a big event for the small town of Big Rock. The judge, a man of considerable girth, stepped down from the train. Have you made arrangements for my accommodations?
Yes, Your Honor. We put you up at the Homestead Hotel.
Uh-huh. Is there a restaurant nearby?
Yes, sir. City Pig is right next door. It's a very fine restaurant, and I have arranged for the town to pick up your tab.
Thank you. I take it that everything's ready for the trial?
Oh, yes. We're all ready for it.
Do the accused men have a lawyer? I'm not going to conduct the trial if they don't have a qualified attorney representing them. Monty and Norton looked at each other for a moment. Seeing their hesitation, Judge Tutwiler stopped. Oh, now don't tell me they aren't represented.
Oh, they're represented all right. Sam Covington is their lawyer.
Sam Covington? Isn't he the governor's man?
Hand in glove.
How did he wind up representing a couple of bank robbers and murderers?
It was his turn, Your Honor. As you know, every lawyer in the county is on a roster and must take his turn representing the indigent. Covington's name came up.
From what I know of Covington, Monty, you can be sure that he will be a powerful adversary. He don't like to lose anything. Well, now, if you gentlemen will show me to the hotel, I'll freshen up, have some dinner, and retire for the night. Court will convene sharply at 9 tomorrow morning, and please make sure that all interested parties are so informed.
Yes, sir.
The next morning, Smoke, Sally, Cal, and Pearly came to town to watch the trial of Jack Tatum and Billy Petrie. It wasn't mere curiosity that brought him to town, because Smoke had been subpoenaed as a witness for the prosecution. The four of them arrived in a trap that was driven by Cal. Pearly sat beside him on the front seat, while Smoke and Sally sat on the back seat.
What time does the trial start?
9 o'clock.
It's just now, a little after 8. Maybe we can get something to eat while we're waiting.
Heavens, Pearly, after that huge breakfast you had, you are still hungry? Oh, what am I saying? Of course you're still hungry. I don't think there is ever a time when you aren't hungry.
I could use a cup of coffee myself.
The four went into the City Pig and found the table.
Good morning, Mr. Jansen, Mrs. Jansen.
Kathy came over to the table.
Are you folks in town for the trial?
Yes.
It seems that everyone is. We've never been so busy. Oh, and everyone's talking about what a hero you were.
Yes, well, people talk too much.
Well, what can I get for you? Our pancakes are awfully good this morning.
Thanks, but we've had breakfast. We're just waiting around until the trial starts. All I want is coffee.
That'll do for me.
Cal also ordered only coffee. But when Kathy got to Pearly, he was still studying the menu.
Pearly?
I had breakfast too, but it was fairly light.
Oh.
Well, I mean it wasn't all that heavy. So I might have just a little something to tide me over until lunch. Maybe a stack of pancakes, with 3 eggs, about 1/2 pound of sausage, some biscuits and gravy ought to do it.
I'll get a work crew started on it right away.
45 minutes later, Smoke, Sally, Pearly, and Cal were in the courthouse, sitting in the second row of seats. They were there when Monty and Deputy Wallace brought in the prisoners, Jack Tatum and Billy Petrie. Jack Tatum looked out over the gallery. The courtroom was packed for the show, and he intended to give them one. No stranger to court appearances, Tatum was a man who had spent at least half of his 42 years in various jails and prisons. He had a misshapen eye, the result of a knife fight that left him permanently scarred, and his adversary permanently dead. There were few laws he hadn't broken and none that he wouldn't. He had started his life a crime when at the age of 14 he sneaked into his mother's bedroom, killed the man she was sleeping with, took his money, and ran away into the night. He had neither seen nor contacted his mother since then, and he neither knew nor cared whether she was dead or alive. Billy Petrie was considerably younger than Tatum. Petrie's mother, a soiled dove, died when he was 12. He never knew who his father was, so when he was orphaned, he became a ward of the state. They put Petrie in a reform school because there was no room for him in the orphanage. He broke out of the reform school when he was 16, and he had lived a life of crime ever since. Although the bullet had been removed from Petrie's leg, the wound was still bothering him. He was limping noticeably as the prisoners were brought into court to await the arrival of the judge. Sitting at the defendant's table and greeting them when they arrived was Samuel B. Covington, appointed by the court as counsel for the defense. Covington was a dapper, distinguished-looking man, exceptionally well-dressed, complete with vest and gold watch chain. His hair was dark, except at the temples, where it was gray. He had a small, well-trimmed mustache. Sam Covington was a well-known lawyer who was very active in politics. In the most recent election, he had directed the successful campaign of the sitting governor. As a result, he was now one of the most powerful men in the state, with the governor's ear anytime he wanted it. Mrs. Edna Flowers was also in the court, the grief over the recent loss evident in her face. The widow's weed she was wearing did little to hide the fact that she was pregnant. Margaret Pynchon was in court as well, sitting next to Mrs. Flowers. Mrs. Pynchon's arm was in a sling, and both she and Mrs. Flowers glared at the defendants as they were brought in.
All rise. Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. This court is now in session. The Honorable Harry Tutwiler presiding. All who have business with this honorable court, draw near and listen. God bless this honorable court, and God bless the United States of America. Order in the court.
Judge Tutwiler, wearing black robes, came in and stood behind the bench for a moment, then sat. Not until then did everyone else sit down. Who now comes before this court?
Your Honor, before this honorable court comes the case of the state against Jack Tatum and William, also known as Billy Petrie. They are charged with murder in the first degree, aggravated assault with the intent to commit murder, bank robbery, and conspiracy to commit bank robbery.
Will the defendants please stand? At Covington's urging, both Tatum and Petrie stood. You have heard the charges against you. How do you plead? Guilty or not guilty?
We didn't do all them things that was just said. I mean, to listen to all that, you'd think...
That was as far as Tatum got before Covington was able to put his hand out toward his client to quiet him.
The defendants plead not guilty, Your Honor.
The plea of not guilty is entered. After they spent nearly an hour selecting the jury, the judge finally turned to Norton. Mr. Prosecutor, make your case, sir. Norton gave his opening remarks, called upon witnesses from the bank, then called his star witness, Smoke Jensen. Reaching over to pat Sally's hand, Smoke walked up to the front of the courtroom where he was sworn in.
Mr. Jensen, would you please, in your own words, tell the court what happened on the morning of the 14th of last month?
Without elaboration, Smoke told the story of being in front of the hardware store when he heard the shooting. He told of watching Mr. Flowers shot down in the street before he himself joined the action. His statement was concise but complete, with no self-aggrandizement.
Your witness, Counselor?
Covington approached Jensen, looked at him for a long moment without saying a word, then moved over to stand in front of the jury.
Mr. Jensen, how many men have you killed?
Objection, Your Honor. That question is inflammatory and irrelevant.
Your Honor, by definition, any time someone is killed, it is inflammatory. But if you allow me to pursue this course, I will be able to establish the relevance.
I will allow the question, Counselor, but be cautious. I will be keeping an eye on you, and if I see you misusing my generosity, I withdraw permission in a heartbeat.
Thank you, Your Honor. How many men have you killed?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure? You mean the act of killing another human being is so insignificant to you that you can't even remember how many you have sent to their maker?
I've never killed anyone who wasn't trying to kill me.
Would you say you have killed more than 10 men?
Yes.
More than 20?
Your Honor, I object. The witness has answered the question. He has killed more than 10 men. I see no reason for carrying this any further.
Objection sustained. Continue the cross-examination.
I am curious, Mr. Jensen. When you killed Mr. Fuller and Mr. Howard, did you pause to reflect upon it?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Before you pulled the trigger that sent Mr. Fuller and Mr. Howard hurling into eternity, did you hesitate, even for a moment?
No.
Did you not even ask yourself if you were doing the right thing?
Mr. Covington, much is said about the speed of a gunfighter's draw. But in reality, it isn't the speed of drawing the gun as much as it is the speed of making the right decision. Once I realized what was going on, I made the decision to intervene. I knew I was right, and I didn't have to reconsider.
I see. Mr. Jensen, what caliber bullets were you shooting on the day in question?
The rifle I fired used .44-40 caliber ammunition.
Are you aware that the shots that killed Fuller and Howard were made from a distance of 175 yards?
I didn't measure the distance.
I did. Given the distance of the shot, don't you think some hesitation might have been prudent? Especially since Richmond Flowers and Mrs. Pynchon were both struck by bullets that are consistent with the caliber of the bullets you were shooting.
Objection! Is defense trying to suggest that Smoke Jensen shot Mr. Flowers and Mrs. Pynchon?
Your Honor, I'm making no such claim. I am merely making the observation that Mr. Flowers was killed and Mrs. Pynchon was wounded by bullets that are consistent with the caliber of the bullets Mr. Jensen was shooting. It goes to establishing doubt.
Objection overruled.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Jensen, you do admit to killing Howard and Fuller, do you not? I mean, that issue is not in doubt.
I killed them.
Would it be fair to say, then, that on that day, you were their judge, jury, and executioner?
Objection, Your Honor. Inflammatory.
Sustained.
Withdraw the question. Mr. Jensen, are you an officer of the law?
No.
Would you consider yourself a vigilante?
No.
Then by what right did you kill Fuller and Howard?
Objection, Your Honor. The witness is not on trial here. Jack Tatum and Billy Petrie are on trial. It is clear to anyone with reason that by his actions, Mr. Jensen saved more innocent lives. I'll not have him browbeaten like this.
Your Honor, this goes to witness credibility. As far as I know, there has been no hearing to determine whether or not Mr. Jensen's homicide was justifiable. And unless or until that happens, any testimony Mr. Jensen may give in this court could be said to be self-serving.
Objection sustained. Unless you can prove that the witness has perjured himself, his testimony will be given relevant weight. Now, please continue.
I have no more questions for this witness.
Redirect?
No redirect, sir. And as Mr. Jensen was my last witness, prosecution rests.
Prosecution having rested, you may now present your case, Mr. Covington.
Thank you. Your Honor, defense wishes to call Sheriff Monty Carson to the stand.
Monty had been one of the prime witnesses for the prosecution, and everyone wondered what the hell use Covington could make of him for the defense.
Sheriff, I remind you that you are still under oath.
I understand.
In the course of your investigation of the events on the 14th of October, were you presented with the bullet that killed Mr. Flowers?
I was.
And I believe you testified that it was a .44 caliber bullet?
It was.
And the bullet that wounded Mrs. Pynchon, also a .44 caliber?
It was.
And under questioning from prosecution, you stated that the pistols you took from the defendants, Jack Tatum and Billy Petrie, were also .44 caliber?
They were.
Now, Sheriff, I would like to ask you a question that prosecution did not ask you. Did you also take the pistols from the two men that Smoke Jensen killed?
Yes.
What caliber were they?
The pistols were Colt 44s.
And the bullet that Dr. Spaulding took from Mrs. Pynchon's shoulder, as well as the bullet he took from Mr. Flowers' body, what caliber were they?
The bullets were .44 caliber.
What about the bullets taken from the bodies of Mr. Howard and Mr. Fuller?
They were .44-40.
Covington walked over to his table and picked up two envelopes. Returning to the witness stand, he held the envelopes in front of him.
Your Honor, I have defense exhibits marked A and B. I beg permission to perform an experiment.
You may proceed.
Sheriff Carson, would you hold out your left hand, please?
Monty did as directed.
I am removing an object from the envelope marked A and placing it in your hand. Would you identify it for the court, please?
He placed a small piece of lead in Monty's hand.
It is a spent bullet.
Caliber?
I'd say it was a .44 caliber.
And now this one.
Covington put another bullet in Monty's right hand.
It's also a bullet.
Caliber?
It's a .44 caliber.
You are correct, Sheriff. This is a .44 caliber bullet. But the bullet you are holding in your left hand is a .44-40. Thank you, Sheriff Carson. No further questions. Defense calls Mr. Jack Tatum to the stand.
Tatum took his seat.
Mr. Tatum, on the 14th of October at approximately 10:15 in the morning, did you, Mr. Petrie, Mr. Howard, and Mr. Fuller attempt to rob the bank of Big Rock?
Yeah, we tried.
Your Honor, if he is confessing to this, why are we continuing with the trial?
Your Honor, if the court will indulge, there is a greater purpose to this.
Continue the questioning.
Tell the court, in your own words, what happened that morning.
Yeah, well, like I said, me, Petrie, Howard, and Fuller was robbing the bank, and everything's going along just fine. I mean, nobody was getting hurt or anything like that, and no one was gonna get hurt. And then when we come out of the bank, someone started shooting at us. Well, first thing I know after that, the bank teller went down. I yelled out to Fuller and Howard, what'd you shoot him for? But instead of answering me, I seen that they were shooting at Jensen. And that's when I first found out that Jensen was the one shooting at us.
Did either you or Petrie return fire?
Well, we shot at Jensen in self-defense, but only at Jensen. Well, we didn't even do that until he started shooting first. Well, then I seen that he's out of range, so I yelled at Petrie to just forget the money so we could get out of there. But that's when he got shot in the leg. Well, I figured then we better surrender before anyone else got hurt or maybe killed. Now, this Jensen fella was going wild, you know what I mean? He's just shooting up the whole town. Now, I admit, I come to town to steal money, but I never had it in mind to hurt anyone. When I seen what Jensen was doing, I figured the only way to keep anyone else from getting shot was as if I surrendered.
Billy Petrie's testimony was almost an exact duplicate of Jack Tatum's. According to Petrie, Smoke Jensen started the shooting. The bank teller was killed, not intentionally, but by a wild shot. Mrs. Pynchon was also hit with a wild shot. Neither of them was shot, Petrie insisted, until after the shooting was started by Smoke Jensen. He added one more thing to his testimony, looking directly at Mrs. Flowers and Mrs. Pynchon.
Ladies, didn't none of us want to hurt anyone? I'm sorry you lost your husband, Mrs. Flowers. I'm sorry you got shot, Mrs. Pynchon, but wasn't neither one of us that done it.
When Petrie stepped down, Covington presented his closing argument.
Some may regard Smoke Jensen as a hero for what he did. I don't share that opinion of Mr. Jensen. By opening fire in an otherwise peaceful street, he placed the lives of everyone in town in mortal danger. Did my clients kill Mr. Flowers? They may have. It is entirely possible. They were shooting, and so were Mr. Howard and Mr. Fuller. Bullets from one or more of their guns may well have killed Richmond Flowers and wounded Mrs. Pynchon. However, it is also possible that Smoke Jensen killed Richmond Flowers.
From his pocket, Covington held up two unfired bullets.
Here you see an unfired .44-40 rifle bullet and an unfired .44 caliber pistol bullet. When they are like this, it is easy to tell the difference. Ah, but the spent bullets.
Returning to his table, Covington picked up the two chunks of lead he had shown to Sheriff Carson.
Are a very different story. Not even Sheriff Carson, who everyone will concede is an expert in these matters, was able to tell for certain which bullet was which. And though I am not saying with certainty that Smoke Jensen killed Mr. Flowers, I am proving to you that it is possible that he did. Now, why would a man like Smoke Jensen open fire when doing so would place ordinary people in danger? That's a good question, and I think it deserves an answer. Smoke Jensen is a successful rancher to whom money is everything. To such a man, money means more than the life of an ordinary person. What exactly is an ordinary person? Rich Flowers was a simple teller, so he was an ordinary person. Mrs. Pynchon is a simple tailor, so she is an ordinary person.
Covington walked away from the jury and fixed his gaze upon Mrs. Flowers and Mrs. Pynchon.
Our government was founded upon the principle of the sovereignty of the ordinary person. People like these two noble ladies. In Jensen's world, such people as Rich Flowers and Margaret Pynchon are unimportant. In Smoke Jensen's world, you, the gentlemen of this jury, are all ordinary people. Thus, you are unimportant. But those of us who are unimportant know something that people like Smoke Jensen will never understand. We know that while money can be replaced, human life cannot. It wasn't lives Jensen thought to save that terrible Tuesday morning. It was money. After all, Jensen's own money is kept in that bank, So he did have a vested interest in stopping the robbery. Incensed by the idea that his money might be stolen, Smoke Jensen began shooting, and now we all know the sad and tragic consequences of that action. Gentlemen of the jury, I do not have to prove that Jack Tatum and Billy Petrie are innocent beyond a shadow of a doubt, but the prosecution must prove they are guilty beyond a shadow of a doubt. So think about that. You heard Sheriff Monte Carson testify that Fuller and Howard were carrying .44 caliber pistols. In order to find Jack Tatum and Billy Petrie guilty beyond the shadow of a doubt, you must be absolutely certain that it was one of their bullets that killed Mr. Flowers. Not a bullet fired by Fuller, nor a bullet fired by Howard, nor even a bullet fired by Smoke Jensen. Because it is entirely possible that Mr. Flowers was killed by one of those three. And if that is the case, then you have no choice but to find these defendants not guilty. Defense rests, Your Honor.
Abner Norton stood at his table, then looked toward the jury.
Mr. Covington has just made a brilliant closing argument for his case, and I applaud him for his attempt to spin straw into gold. My closing won't take long. We have seven witnesses who testified about what they saw that day. Their stories varied somewhat, but no more than could be expected in relating accounts of such horrifying events. But all of them agreed on one thing. Smoke Jensen only fired three times, and all three of those bullets are accounted for. One killed Howard, one killed Fuller, and the third was taken from Billy Petrie's leg. Finally, it does not matter whether the bullet that killed Rich Flowers was fired by Howard or Fuller. Legally, the act by any one of the four men who attempted to rob that bank is shared equally by all four parties. And if anyone is killed resulting from mala in se, which is a legal term meaning an act of malice, then that killing, whether by intent or accident, is murder. There is only one finding you can return, and that is the finding of guilty. Prosecution rests, Your Honor.
When the jury retired for deliberation, Smoke, Sally, Cal, and Pearly went back to the same restaurant where they had had their morning coffee.
Do you think Mr. Covington really believes everything he said?
If he does believe it, then he's an even bigger fool than he looks.
He is a lawyer. His job is to get his clients off by whatever means possible.
Well, he doesn't have to lie about it, does he?
Well, I don't think we have much to worry about. Abner did a pretty good job at taking Covington's argument apart. And let's not forget that Tom Burke is foreman of the jury. I can tell you for a fact that he won't be buying any of Covington's bluster.
Just down the street from the restaurant, in the defendant's room of the courthouse, Tatum and Petrie sat across a table from Covington.
So, what do you think? Jury let us go free?
Let you go free? Are you insane? You were caught red-handed robbing the bank. You even admitted as much from the stand. The best you can possibly hope for is that you don't hang. Either way, you're going to prison.
Prison? Well, I thought you were supposed to be a good lawyer.
There's not a lawyer alive who could get you declared not guilty. As it is, I've alienated everyone in town by the way I've attacked Smoke Jensen. He is held in very high regard by folks in these parts.
Yeah. Well, he's not held in high regard by me. If it hadn't been for him, we'd be in New Mexico by now spending our money.
Monte Carson stuck his head in.
Jury's in.
After taking his seat at the bench, Judge Harry Tutwiler adjusted the glasses on the end of his nose. Would the prisoners come before the bench? Tatum and Petrie moved up to stand in front of the judge. Mr. Foreman of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
What is the verdict?
Your Honor? We have found these guilty sons of bitches guilty.
Order! I will have order in my court.
The judge looked over at the foreman.
So say you all?
So say we all.
The judge took off his glasses and began polishing them as he studied the two prisoners before him.
Jack Tatum and Billy Petrie, you have been tried by a jury of your peers, and you have been found guilty of the crimes of robbery and murder. Before this court passes sentence, have you anything to say?
What? You mean like beg for mercy or something like that? Oh, yeah, you go on, you fat-ass son of a bitch. Sentence us and get it over with.
Jack Tatum and Billy Petrie, it is the sentence of this court that you be taken from this place and put in jail just long enough to witness one more night pass from this mortal coil. At a time to be fixed by the sheriff, though no later than noon on the morrow, you are to be removed from jail and transported to a place where you will be hanged by the neck until you are dead.
Your Honor, we can't hang him in the morning. We don't have a gallows yet.
The court authorizes the use of a tree, a lamppost, a hay-loading stanchion, or any other device, fixture, apparatus, contrivance, agents, or means as may be sufficient to suspend the prisoner's carcasses above the ground, bringing about the effect of breaking their damn necks, collapsing their windpipes, and in all and any way squeezing the last breath of life from their worthless, vile, and miserable bodies.
Deputy Wallace had been napping at his desk in Monty's office when something, a noise or perhaps a dream, awakened him.
What? What is it?
He opened his eyes and looked around the inside of Monty's office. The room was dimly lit by a low-burning kerosene lantern. A plethora of wanted posters fluttered from the bulletin board. A pot of aromatic coffee sat on a small wood-burning stove. The regulator clock's hands pointed to 10 minutes after 2 in the morning. Wallace rubbed his eyes, then stood up. He went to the stove to pour himself a cup of coffee, then stepped over to the jail cell to look inside, expecting to see the prisoners asleep. He was startled to see that both Tatum and Petrie were wide awake, sitting on the edges of their bunks.
What's the matter? Can't you fellas sleep any?
No.
Well, I wouldn't worry about it. Just about 4 more hours or so, you won't have no trouble at all going to sleep. You'll be sleeping forever. Ah, coffee is one of the sweetest pleasures of life, don't you think? But then, life itself is sweet, ain't it?
Wallace gasped in surprise at seeing a Mexican standing between him and his desk. He had not heard the man come in. The Mexican was wearing an oversized sombrero and had a dark mustache which curved down along each side of his mouth.
Hell you doing in here, Mex? You aren't supposed to be in here.
I have come to work, senor. Sweep floor.
Sweep the floor at 2 o'clock in the morning? Are you crazy? Get the hell out of here.
Deputy.
Now what do you want?
Wallace turned back toward the jail cell. He was surprised to see both Tatum and Petrie smiling broadly.
I want you to be nice to our friend, Senor Sanchez.
Your friend?
Suddenly, Wallace realized what he had done. He had just turned his back on the Mexican. Too late. Wallace felt the Mexican's hand come around the clasp over his mouth. As he was losing consciousness, Wallace saw the Mexican opening the cell doors. Tatum and Petrie hurried out. Tatum came over to look down at Wallace.
Deputy, when you get to hell, tell old Fuller and Howard hello for us, will you?
Horses and alley behind Calaboose. Come.
Not yet. We got us a little job to take care of.
What's that?
The judge is staying over in the hotel till after the hanging. We need to give him our regrets, tell him we're sorry we can't make it.
The three men left the jail, then slipped through the shadows down the street to the hotel. Moving in through the front door, they walked over to the counter.
He's in 203.
Taking the spare key to the room, the three men left the desk clerk undisturbed. Then they moved quickly and quietly up to the second floor. They walked down the carpeted hallway until they found the door.
Son of a bitch ain't losing no sleep over sentencing us to hang, is he?
No, senor.
Sanchez put his finger over his mouth to indicate the need for silence.
Sanchez is right. You use the gun, it's gonna make too much noise.
I'll kill him for you.
Wait! I want the son of a bitch to wake up long enough to know what happened to him.
Sanchez nodded. Tatum put his hand on the judge's shoulder.
Judge! Judge, wake up!
What is it? Who's there?
It's a couple of friends of yours, Judge. Jack Tatum and Billy Petrie. We just killed a deputy and broke jail. We come to tell you goodbye.
What?
Tatum started looking around the room.
Come on! What the hell are you looking for? You know this old fart doesn't have any money. Let's go before someone hears us.
This is what I was looking for.
Tatum held something up that gleamed softly in the dim light.
What is that?
The judge's gavel. I want something to remember him by.
Then, slipping down through the alley, the trio of killers and thieves mounted their horses and rode off into the night. When Monty walked down to the jailhouse at just after 7 o'clock the next morning, he passed the carpenters who were working on the gallows. Because of the time constraints and the fact that the judge had authorized the hanging to be from any such contrivance as they might be able to find, Monty and a few others had come up with an ingenious solution. The stoutest of any of the pillars in town holding a porch roof were the pillars of the hardware store. Thus, it was there they decided to attach a cross piece that would protrude out into the street. At the street end of the protruding cross piece, a second post was placed to support it, resulting in an upside-down U. Underneath the U, there was a plank for Tatum and Petrie to stand on. When the support post for the plank was suddenly removed, the drop would be sufficient to break the necks of the condemned men. Several people were already gathered around the makeshift gallows, watching and talking.
What time is the hanging to be, Sheriff?
8:30, about another hour and a half. Has anyone seen the judge this morning?
Highfalutin fella like the judge don't get out of bed this time of day. He said any time before noon. My thinking is he was hoping that's about when you'd do it so he wouldn't lose any sleep.
Well, if any of you see him, tell him I'm down at the jail. I'm going down to relieve Wallace so he can get some breakfast.
Oh, we'll tell him, Monty.
Monty reached the jailhouse door and tried to open it, but he was surprised to find it locked.
Dewey? Dewey, you in there? Why have you got the door locked? Dewey, I'm here. If you want any breakfast, you better...
Even from the door, he could see the blood on the floor. And when he stepped around the desk for a better look, he saw his deputy lying in a pool of blood, his throat cut and his eyes open, opaque now, but still reflecting the horror of his last moment on Earth.
Jesus, Dewey.
Monty hurried back down the walk toward the hotel. He passed the carpenters and their audience on his way.
You forget something, Monty?
Deputy Wallace is dead. The prisoners are gone.
The hell you say? How did it happen?
He's lying on the floor with his throat cut. The judge isn't gonna like this.
Monty hurried down to the city pig, figuring to catch the judge at breakfast. When he came in, Kathy walked over to him.
You mean Mary's going to let you have breakfast with us this morning?
Nah, I'm looking for the judge. Has he come in for breakfast yet?
I haven't seen him.
I would have thought he would have been here by now. All right, I'll check the hotel. If I miss him and you see him, would you tell him I'm looking for him?
Sure thing, Monty.
When Monty crossed the lobby of the hotel, he saw the clerk sweeping the lobby floor.
Has the judge come down yet?
Not yet.
What's his room number?
203.
Monty went upstairs. When he reached the second floor, he stepped over to room 203.
Judge! Judge Tutwiler, you awake? Judge! Judge, wake up!
When the judge still didn't answer, Monty went back downstairs.
Do you have an extra key to the judge's room?
Yep.
The clerk started back toward the registration desk. He reached up toward a large board covered with nails from which keys were hanging. His hand started toward 203, but then it stopped. That nail was empty.
Oh, that's funny.
What's funny? What is it? What's wrong?
The extra key is gone.
You sure? You sure you didn't give two keys to the judge?
I'm positive. The extra key was hanging right here. I know it was here last night because I saw it. I don't have the slightest idea what happened to it.
Damn, I'm afraid I do.
Turning, Monty went back up the stairs, but this time he was taking them two at a time, although he knew in his gut that any need for hurrying was long over. Puzzled by the sheriff's strange behavior, The hotel clerk hurried up behind him. This time, Monty made no effort to knock on the door or even try the doorknob.
Hey, what are you doing?
Monty took one step into the room, then he stopped.
Holy hell.
The bed on which the judge was lying was soaked in blood. Like Deputy Wallace, the judge's eyes were open and opaque. And like Wallace's eyes, these two reflected the horror of his death. Jack Tatum had met Raul Sanchez 6 months earlier when the Mexican came to him with information about a shipment of rifles to the Mexican army. Tatum, Sanchez, and a half dozen others had hit the freight wagon, killed the Mexican army guards, and taken the shipment of repeating rifles. Their initial plan had been to sell it to one of the several revolutionary groups operating in northern Sonora, but none of the groups had enough money to make the deal worthwhile. So Tatum came up with a new plan, a particularly ambitious one, which would require several more men. After breaking Tatum and Petrie out of jail, Raul Sanchez went his own way, intending to round up the men they would need to carry out Tatum's plan. Sanchez and Tatum had agreed to meet in Risco, a tiny town in northern New Mexico territory. Tatum was pulled out of his reverie by Billy Petrie, who was riding behind him.
Jack! Jack!
Twisting in his saddle, Tatum saw that Petrie had fallen from his horse. Tatum rode back and looked down at him.
We ain't making no time with you falling off your horse every mile or so.
I can't help it, Jack. This here leg is killing me. The wound is festered.
Tatum pulled the knife, knelt down by Petrie, and ripped his pants leg open. The leg was swollen and blue. He put his hand on the leg near the bullet entry and felt its heat.
You're in bad shape.
I'll be all right, since I get where I can rest a little.
Nah, you ain't gonna get all right.
Maybe a doctor could...
Ah, there ain't no doctor in Risco. And even if there was, about the only thing he could do for you is take the leg off.
No! No, I ain't gonna let no doctor do that.
Well, you think you can get mounted?
Yeah.
Petrie got up, then reached for the saddle horn. With a mighty effort, he heaved himself up, only to fall on the other side.
Sorry, Billy, but I ain't got time to take care of you.
Don't you worry about me.
Oh, I ain't worried.
Jack! No! What are you gonna do?
It's best this way, Billy. You wouldn't want to go through the rest of your life without a leg now, would you?
Listen, Jack. No, don't!
Tatum started to leave him there. Then, looking down, he saw the snakeskin boots Petrie was so proud of.
No sense letting these go to waste. I just take them with me as a keepsake, so to speak.
Kneeling at Petrie's feet, he pulled the snakeskin boots off, one at a time. Then, taking the reins of Petrie's horse, he rode off, even as the vultures were circling. Tom Burke, the man who had acted as foreman for the jury that convicted Tatum and Petrie, gave a barbecue on his ranch, Timber Notch. It was a gala event, with half a steer turning on a spit over an open fire, tended to by a couple of Tom's hired hands. He had invited everyone who served with him on the jury, as well as the sheriff, the bailiff, and all his neighboring ranchers. Sugarloaf was adjacent to Timber Notch, which meant that Smoke, Sally, Pearly, and Cal were included in the invitation. The barbecue was given as a way of getting everyone together and settled back down again after the events of the recent past. The attempted bank robbery, the killing of Richmond Flowers, and more recently, the killings of Deputy Wallace and Judge Tutwiler. The party was supposed to help people put everything behind them, but throughout the large house, there were little groups of guests all talking about the same thing, the events of the recent past. Not until one of the hands came in carrying a large joint of beef did the subject change.
Here's the first carving, folks. If you'll get in line at the table there when you get to the meat, I'll serve you.
Although the steer had been cooked over an open pit, it was a little cold outside, so the servant was inside. A long table, laden with vegetables and salads, provided the side dishes. There were at least 40 people in attendance, and they were going down each side of the table, loading their plates with the salads and vegetables. Then they took their plates to another table where Tom was carving the meat. As Tom carved the meat, his wife, Jo Ellen, served. Jo Ellen was wearing a gold chain from which hung a sparkling diamond. It was an anniversary gift from Tom, and she had been showing it off proudly.
Have you seen my new diamond?
It's pretty all right, but I'd just as soon as not be showing it off to Sally. Next thing you know, she'll be wanting one.
Oh, as if you wouldn't get it for her, Smoke Jensen. I know you. You'd do anything Sally asked you to do, and why wouldn't you? She's a wonderful woman.
Well, I reckon I'll confess to that.
Pearlie was right behind Smoke, and he held his plate out to Jo Ellen while she put a generous portion of beef on it. When Pearlie looked a little disappointed, she smiled at him.
Would you like a little more?
Yes, ma'am, if you don't mind.
Say when.
Jo Ellen put another large slice of beef on his plate. And when he didn't pull it back, she put another.
Damn, Smoke, you didn't tell me I was going to have to butcher half my herd just to feed Pearlie.
That boy does have an appetite.
Appetite? He doesn't have an appetite, he has a bottomless pit.
After Tom had carved enough meat, he got his own plate, then found Smoke and joined him. Tom had recently announced that he would soon be going to Texas to buy blooded bulls, and some of the other ranchers were already making arrangements to buy stud services from him.
When are you leaving, and how long do you think you'll be gone?
Well, I'll be leaving sometime in the next 2 weeks. It'll take me 2 days to get there by train, maybe a week to find the bulls, and 2 days back. I'll make it about 2 weeks that I'll be gone.
Tom's young son brought his own plate over and sat down beside him.
What are you doing here, buddy? I thought all the kids were outside playing down at the pond.
They're running around putting frogs down the girls' dresses. I don't have time for that kid stuff.
You're 12 years old. If you don't have time for it now, when will you have time for it?
Never. Anyway, you're talking about going to Texas to get the bulls, aren't you?
Yes.
That's more interesting than playing with frogs. Buddy, would you please come take this plate over to Mrs. Pynchon? Yes, ma'am.
Pearlie pointed to the boy as he walked away.
That kid acts older than you do, Cal.
Jo Ellen and I are convinced that Buddy's not really a kid. We think he's a full-grown man, passing himself off as a kid.
Well, look at it this way. If he keeps up his interest in the ranch, you'll have a homegrown foreman in no time at all.
Did you read that letter in the paper from Judge Tutwiler's wife, thanking the town for the flowers they sent to his funeral?
Yes, it was a nice letter. It's a shame what happened to him and the deputy.
You should have killed both those sons of bitches while you had the chance.
It would have been better if I had.
Where do you think they are now?
If I were them, I'd be in California. Or Washington State, maybe. Anywhere, as long as it's somewhere far away from here.
It was after midnight when Tatum rode into the tiny town of Risco in northern New Mexico territory. It had been 6 days since he escaped, and 4 days since he left Billy Petrie dead on the desert floor. Using some of the money he had stolen from the deputy and the judge, he bought a bottle of tequila at the cantina. Then he picked up a Mexican whore, taking her as much for her bed as for any of the special services she could provide for him. Risco was a scattering of fly-blown, crumbling adobe buildings laid out around a dusty plaza. What made it attractive to people like Tatum was the fact that it had neither constable nor sheriff, and visitations by law officers from elsewhere in the territory were strongly discouraged. In fact, there was a place in the town cemetery prominently marked as Lawman's Plot. There, two deputy sheriffs, one deputy U.S. Marshal, and an Arizona Ranger, all uninvited visitors to the town, lay buried. Tatum woke up the next morning with a ravenous hunger. The puta was still asleep beside him. The covers were askew, exposing one enormous pillow-sized blue-veined breast and a fat leg that dangled over the edge of the bed. A bit of spittle drooled from the whore's vibrating lips. She didn't wake up when Tatum crawled over her to get out of bed and get dressed. He looked at the snakeskin boots, then smiled as he pulled them off. They were every bit as comfortable as Petrie had said they were.
Hell, if I'd known the boots felt this good, I'd have shot you a long time ago.
Dressed now, he walked over to the table where he had seen the woman put the money last night. He took the money back, then let himself out and went downstairs. Tatum was sitting at a table in the back of the cantina, having a breakfast of beans, tortillas, and beer, when Pig Iron McCord came in. Pig Iron wasn't very tall, but he was a powerfully built man, bald with a prominent brow ridge, thick lips, and heavily muscled arms that seemed too long for his body. Seeing Tatum, Pig Iron came back to join him.
Well, Sanchez told me you'd be here.
Did he tell you what I got in mind?
He said you were gonna sell guns to the engines.
That's right.
You ain't gonna make no money that way. The engines are gone straight. They got their own money. They can buy guns anytime they want. Hell, they can even order them from a catalog.
The treaty allows them to buy guns for hunting purposes only. And there's a limit to how many they can buy.
Why would they want any more than they can buy?
Well, because they're gonna be in a war. You can't fight a war if you don't have enough guns.
Hell, Tatum, you've been in jail a long time. Except for the Sioux and their ghost dancers, there ain't no Indians nowhere that's on the warpath.
Well, that's the way it is now, but don't have to stay that way.
What do you mean?
Soon as we get through causing trouble, there'll be Indians on the warpath. I guarantee it.
What are we gonna do?
You let me worry about that. In the meantime, we're gonna need some men. You think you can round up a few?
Sure, if they don't all have to be white Anglos.
They don't. In fact, I already got me a couple of half-breed Indians going to throw in with us. We need them to make the plan work.
How soon you want me to get them?
As soon as you can. Is there any paper out on you up in Colorado?
No, not that I know of.
Good. As soon as you get a few men rounded up, I want you to take one of them with you and go on up to Big Rock and have a look around. You wait for me up there. I'll join you as soon as everything's ready.
All right. You said take a look around. What am I looking for?
The man who was the foreman on the jury that convicted me is named Tom Burke. I understand he has a ranch somewhere near Big Rock. I want you to find out where it is and how many men he's got working for him. Because the first thing I aim to do after I get back up there is to pay that son of a bitch a little visit.